Hi, everyone. This is Zach Sherman, and welcome back to Handling the Heat, the podcast by RestaurantEquipment.biz, where we dive into the real stories behind the people powering the food service industry. On today's episode, I'm joined by Doug Renfro, president of Renfro Foods and third-generation leader of Mrs. Renfro Salsa. We talk about what it means to carry forward an 85-year family legacy while driving modern growth across retail, food service, and private label. Doug shares his journey from corporate finance back to the factory floor, how he turned R&D into both a creative and data-driven process, and why scaling innovation matters as much as flavor. We also get into managing 2022's inflation crisis, cooking up in spreadsheets, the rise of mango habanero, and how the Renfro family continues to honor its roots while embracing what's next for one of America's most beloved salsa brands. Let's dive into it. Doug, thank you so much for joining us here on Handling the Heat. Super excited to chat with you about Renfro Foods and Mrs. Renfro Salsa.
Awesome. I'm happy to be here.
So, Doug, one thing we ask everybody before we get started in the interview is what's something you've eaten recently that you've really enjoyed?
Well, recently we celebrated our 40th anniversary by going to Tuscany, and we took a truffle hunting excursion with a dog and then a pasta making class. And my wife and I made fresh pasta from scratch, and they shaved in some of the truffles the dog had just found. And of course, they're serving us Chianti Classico and Prosecco the whole time.
Wow.
That was delicious and confirmed to us that we do not care to make our own pasta very often.
You know, the box is not as good, but you know, time is taste, maybe. I don't know. But cool. Well, Doug, let's start at the beginning, because I think your journey is super interesting, given that Renfro Foods is a third generation company. And you kind of took a more meandering route, maybe, than others in the generic kind of family business journey. So can you talk to me a little bit about your background and how you found yourself back working with your cousins and the rest of the Renfros?
Sure. Yeah, I do. Sometimes CPAs get credit for listening to me, which I find terrifying. But I will title that talk, How Finance Weenie Got to Be Paid to Play with Food. And, you know, typical family business. Every summer since sixth grade, I wanted money. And they're like, cool, you can come to the factory and work for $5 a day cash and do the worst jobs we have. So I literally started, you know, sweeping, carrying bags of cabbage in 100-degree weather for a trailer, because chow chow, southern relish, was pretty much all we made when I was a child. It's like 0.1% of our sales now. But every summer since sixth grade all the way up into college, and in college, I lived at home, commuted like 30, 40 miles to college, came back and mixed our spices from like 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the factory by myself. Usually everybody else had gone later. And that was glamorous, because I had the world's most interesting smelling Subaru. You had like garlic behind my ear and cumin on my shirt. So, you know, as glamorous as that was, I got out of school early and went to work for Ross Perot's company, EDS, wearing a coat and tie every day in Dallas with a bunch of smart, nice people. Great training. Good money, got my MBA, CMA, about 7-8 years. But I always say a corporate job is great to start, and it will suck the soul out of your body as you get promoted and you're just doing political stuff. So came back in 1992. My dad and my uncle, they needed to either sell out or find, you know, they needed to take it to the next level or sell out. And they weren't big enough, thank God, to sell out, and didn't want to. And so I joined. Two of my cousins were already here. And they literally just made up jobs as I got here. Nutrition panels had just come out. So my uncle said, go figure that out. You know, fun things. I took over R&D immediately, created all the recipes for like the next 20 years and worked with customers to help develop recipes, zero training. And, you know, it's really fun to be able to make your mark. Now, we weren't making much money, but being able to see your grandmother, you know, put my grandmother on the lid, and then we put her on the label, and creating products that had never existed before at a grocery level at a value price where everybody could buy it, you know, not just a gourmet housewarming gift price.
Doug, my journey is not too dissimilar, I would say, to yours. I worked in corporate jobs and, you know, got higher education degrees and then came back to work for my family business. And one of the things that I find you know, difficult but interesting is how you interact with your family in a more professional kind of setting. And it sounds like you were doing that from the sixth grade on, but it's different when you're sweeping up and mixing spices through to when you're, you know, actually doing R&D and, you know, running in a more, you know, leadership type position. So how did that initial year or so go when you're coming back and you've had all these other experiences and you're coming back into the family business? What was that interaction like with your other family members, with your cousins, your dad, your uncle? And how did that kind of progress as you continued these jobs that they made up along the way?
Yeah, I've spoken to the TCU family business class probably 9 years in a row. And one of the things I tell them that as a family business, you know, like my uncle viewed me in diapers because that's the way he met me. And it was really hard the first probably 5 years for him to understand. I had been managing 25 MBA CPAs at a $1 billion firm, but he could just see me as the little kid, you know, that used to climb on boxes and stuff. And there were things where I thought this is an obvious decision and it would take me 3-4 years to get it approved. But also I had a lot of freedom. I always joked that my dad was production. My uncle was in the office. They had equal voting share. I always joked my dad's job was to keep my uncle from firing me when I walked too close to the edge. But we did get along, and my uncle and my cousins and I in particular have always had this understanding of business versus personal. So we could be in a meeting and I could say to you, what you just said, I think it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And business-wise, where do you want to go to lunch? And that worked great for us. We understood that boundary. And to this day, my cousins and I, we can disagree pretty strongly and then immediately go to lunch or go to each other's house for a baby shower or something, because we don't consider business and personal to be the same.
Yeah. And I think that's important, probably in any, you know, corporate capacity, any kind of business, and even more so in a family business, definitely. One of the things, Doug, that I admire about Renfro Foods and Mrs. Renfro Salsa is the legacy. And I think third generation businesses, especially when you have people coming in with new ideas, it's hard to reconcile how do I, you know, cherish and honor this legacy that your, you know, previous two generations have, you know, built upon in the current day when you have so many other things that have to be taken into consideration that maybe didn't have to in the same way back then. So when you first started, and I guess, you know, more moving towards what you've done over the last, you know, 30 years or so, how do you consider legacy when talking through innovation, whether that be product R&D, new marketing campaigns, things of that sort?
I mean, fundamentally, the way we reference and think about that primarily is in terms of integrity. My grandparents, my dad, my late uncle have, you know, huge high levels of integrity. So when suppliers talk to us, potential suppliers, bankers, whoever, we always emphasize for us, quality is first, service is second, price is third. And we treat every decision that way of, you know, my grandmother is always looking over us. You know, she's on the labels, and you know, at the trade show, we've got my granddad looking down on us, you know, when we're in New York or Vegas or wherever, the trade show at our booth. And you want to always do things that would make them proud. And, you know, it's pretty easy guideline. You know, if something seems a little sketchy or gray area, if you think about it for a minute, it's probably like a bad idea.
Right.
But it's funny, you know, as far as product innovation, you know, 95% of the things we made, my granddad wouldn't have known what that was. My dad's 88 and a half, and he's not eaten a lot of the stuff we make now. Because remember, we're about one-third Mrs. Renfro's, one-third making store label products for other people, and then one-third food service. So there's a lot going on here below the scenes. You know, we may have 400 recipes we're working on at any time, and you can't eat them all. Hey, you'd gain like 900 pounds. Also, you know, some things are not in your sweet spot of what you ate growing up, and that's just generational. My kids would be eating things I've never heard of.
Totally. So, Doug, given that split of the business, right, you have your label, private label, and food service, where do you find yourself spending the most time on a day-to-day basis? And which do you enjoy? Because that might be a different answer.
Yeah, I enjoy the R&D the most. And unfortunately, they don't let me do that anymore. If it's Renfro, I will do it. But Renfro, we just came out with a collab with a 100-year-old family-owned pickle company that's about a mile from us, our new product, spicy pickle sauce. And that was awesome. And that was fun. But I've got a right-hand guy now that creates and recipes and for customers and works with them and does all that. For me, marketing is still a lot of fun. We dropped a Taylor Swift theme related holiday email yesterday, which has generated like 100 gift box orders this morning, which does not happen often. You have all kinds of great ideas and there usually nothing happens. This one is, that sort of stuff is fun, but I'm looking at, purchasing contracts because the inflation's been brutal since 2022, post-COVID supply chain. You can't assume that because you ordered it, it's going to show up, alternate, secondary, tertiary suppliers. I'm looking at the financials every day, watching like a hawk. And that I do a lot of tours still, personally. It's great outreach. And please don't tell everybody on this that we do tours. But, if you know me or you're the local, we have a new director of the Modern Art Museum, the sheriff, prospective customer from Connecticut. People like seeing it's like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. People don't understand how many moving parts are involved to make 195 jars a minute, of salsa.
Yeah, the scale is staggering, especially when you have as many SKUs and recipes that you said over 400. How does that work with your R&D processing? Because I would think that, and especially with the supply chain issues that you're talking about, the spiciest, which I've had the opportunity to try, the spicy ghost pepper, blow your socks off type of salsa, the sourcing of these more specialty ingredients, but also trying to make sure that you can make something at scale or whatever scale you anticipate the product to be. How does that play into and what's your thought process trying to combine R&D from the more practical supply chain, processing both inbound for the ingredients and then like where it's actually getting sold? Because my guess is the spicy, over the top salsas, even though it's popular in certain groups, is not the most, I would think the spicy pickle has a little bit more legs for the general population than the, ghost pepper, triple X, those types of flavors.
Yeah, it's a great question because you're right. One of the first things I look at as far as a new flavor idea is, can we make a million jars of it if we need to? Because if you can't, there's no reason for us to come out with it. Retailers get very annoyed if you run out of something. And so we're not dealing with somebody growing it down the street, or a smaller supplier. We have to be super careful on pre-qualifying vendors. And we have a network of ingredient brokers. There's people, if you go to a cocktail party, people don't tend to know. There are people whose whole lives are multi-generational ingredient brokerage. And their job is to know who can make, fire-roasted potato chips or this oleo resin, some obscure pepper, that sort of thing. So my assistant and I, we have an email where you send a blind copy, you hit a button and you say, hey, I need fire roasted coconut puree. Do you have it or not? And the ingredient brokers come back and tell us if they think they can get it. And then we look at minimum order quantity, getting samples, pricing. Do we have to get it delivered? Do we have to buy a truckload versus can we just buy a pallet? These are all the things you do that I call it cooking with Microsoft Excel. I cook everything in the spreadsheet first, but there's no reason for us to physically make a delicious product that's going to be $800 a jar on the shelves.
Yeah, unless it's got gold and truffle in it. Like you're Italian, you could source right. Some of those Italian truffles to mix into a new flavor. That is interesting. And I think one of the things too is this like risk versus reward, which is applicable to all of the innovations that you've done, particularly I think the marketing rebrand that happened in the late teens. You said you had your grandmother on every jar. You go around to your trade shows with your grandfather cutouts. What is the, like when you're going through launching a new flavor or a product expansion or this label rebrand, how do you evaluate the risk versus reward separate and apart from just the financial implications of whether or not we can make a jar of salsa, not $800.
It's tricky because the last new item we had right at COVID time was a blackberry Serrano. And as you get more exotic like that, some of those ingredients have much higher fluctuations crop to crop than others. Tomatoes are fairly stable. They're going to go like this, you know, there. Blackberry can go like that. And so you might actually lose money on every jar you sell of an item for a year and then make lots of money the next year because of the core, you know, named ingredient. So we look very hard at that. Honestly, 80-20 works in all of life. So the key items that we have now doing most of the sales are going to continue to do most of the sales for the most part. About once every 15 years, you might get a new one that enters that race. Mango habanero, I thought it was time that would be something we could do, and most people still thought it was crazy around here. And now, of course, that's just a normal flavor you see all over the place. But that became our number one item over about a 10-year period. But most new items, you eventually discontinue them or they flounder along, providing variety for people, but they don't normally become a top seller.
What's been your, like, Doug in the lab thinking, cooking up something either before the spreadsheet that you think is going to be, you know, bestseller and then totally flopped? Because I would guess with like the mad scientist Doug hat on, you know, you've really come up with some out there interesting flavors. What has been the biggest miss in terms of you thought it was going to be this and then expectations just were completely overstated?
I mean, I don't love looking backward or dwelling on the negative, but pomegranate chipotle, I was thinking, you know, at the time, palm wonderful, antioxidants, sweet heat, pepper combinations and fruit. I wouldn't say it was a total failure. We would sell maybe, you know, 30, 40,000 jars a year, but for our scale, that was, it limped along forever and I had to put it out of its misery. But I can make you a 3-gallon batch, you know, if you need some for the hot.
But definitely give it a go. But I don't know if that's my, you know, that's my flavor profile. I think I stick more with the
nobody else either.
So Doug, I know you just said you don't like to look back, but I think one of the things that we like to highlight is, you know, tough times in business and how people go through and, you know, find ways in which to, succeed in spite of, or, you know, as a result of either crises or, you know, whatever. And in the moment, everything feels like it's on fire. So right. I'm curious, you know, what potentially one of those stories is for you. This is called handling the heat, which isn't, you know, habanero, ghost pepper, you know, type of heat. It's, although, you know, in this case, maybe it is, but our podcast is called Handling the Heat because the people that are successful in any business, but I think in food and beverage in particular, kind of enjoy being in that heat and working through it and handling, you know, themselves with as much composure as you can when you're in those types of crises. So I'm curious if you could maybe talk through a situation or a moment where, you know, things weren't necessarily going as planned and you needed to pivot in order to, you know, push through and succeed.
The most recent time that I would have come home and told my wife we might need to move into a cardboard box under the freeway was 2022, when overnight, one day I get a notice that our metal lids are going to go 45% in 30 days. And then tomatoes went up 35%, then mango. And it just was every day an ingredient or supply was going up strong double digits. And we were in a mentality historically, we raised our prices like 3-5% maybe every 3 years. And everybody did that. It always worked. And we had to give like 5 months, 6 months notice. And overnight it was going to, I did the math, like we're not going to be here if we wait this long to raise it. But our sales channel didn't understand the world had changed. And I was getting pretty freaked out. Your dad and I are in an organization called YPO. And I have this share group that's non-competitive food processors that I was able to tap into and say, talk me off the ledge. And instantly they gave me 2 or 3 ideas that helped tremendously help me sleep at night and execute a plan. And we were able to, and also we make products for so many other people. We had to help them along the way. They didn't know how to tell the retailers, hey, I know you don't want a 30% price increase, but I'm not going to go bankrupt just for you. And here's what we're going to do. And by the way, you know, within 6 months, everybody was doing it. Everybody was shell shocked. It was the new normal. But I would tell you a peer group is key. Don't try to do it yourself. You know, you feel so alone if you're just trying to figure this out yourself. And usually nobody's that smart. A few people are, but not me.
No, I think having people that you can bounce ideas off of, especially in times of crises, is critical. And I think it's also interesting in the way that you describe it is a lot of people go through the crisis is like, how do I succeed versus how do we succeed, which I think is critical, especially given all of the, it's like a domino effect that, you know, a lot of, you know, restaurants deal with, obviously food service, you know, the CPG type businesses, where if everything isn't symbiotic and, you know, moving as it should, then everybody can fail. How does that play into your customer acquisition process, either through customer acquisition or sales channel acquisition? Like, how do you walk into a room, Doug, with, you know, a new grocery line or whatever it may be, and try to share that, you know, here's the legacy that we have and here's how we succeed together? Or is it the product speaks for itself so much that you don't necessarily need to do that as much?
We are a bit lazy. That when you've been around 85 years, you know, we're the largest independent salsa brand in the country. Don't get excited because the you know, we're like number 8 out of 600 brands. That's cool, but if we doubled, we'd be number 8. Because the big ones are big, which is why we make so many things for other people. But yeah, knowing that we're here, we're stable, we're nice, we're fair, we're dependable. We don't run people out of product. We don't ship late. We don't ship short. And in the industry, it's a very small world and people talk. And frankly, people come to us after being disgruntled with someone else or because their friend they respect told them we could take care of them. And the innovation aspect, it's not uncommon for somebody to bring us their 2 recipes, which we execute for them to the letter. But then 3 years later, they want, let's say, a verde instead of the red sauces, and they don't have a verde recipe. We will work with them and create one for them with them that is theirs, as long as, you know, we're making it for them. And they appreciate the fact that we can do that, and we can value engineer. My R&D guy is trained. He will slap your hand if you try to put in too much fresh cilantro, because he knows it's a waste of time. You can't afford that much fresh cilantro, no matter how tasty that is, if you're trying to hit an everyday grocery price.
Interesting. For the private label stuff that you're doing for others, Doug, how much does your feedback make an impact on like their recipes? Or maybe just talk me through the process, because it's something I'm curious about too, where if I need Renfro Foods to make me this salsa and I've done the R&D and I feel comfortable with this recipe and I hand it off to you and you're like, or your QA guy's like, why are you putting in this much cilantro? It's not really going to make an impact. You know, how does that back and forth work? Or are people fairly adamant that like, this is how people know us, this is how much cilantro I need in my salsa, and here's what it is, regardless of how we're going to do it?
There's two camps. And as you get more technical, private label in our world technically means store brand. So think of your favorite retailer. When your favorite retailer comes to us, they normally don't have a recipe. And often they ask our opinion, what should we do? We've never done private label salsa, or we want to tweak it. And they will ask our opinion and we'll suggest things like ghost pepper, mango habanero, mild, medium, hot, verde, whatever. And half the time they'll go with our suggestions and we literally make up recipes for them. Half the time they tell us to do the opposite of what we suggested. It's their money. So that's one camp. The other camp, I think you're thinking about at Copac, which is Zach has a recipe, which he loves, and just needs Renfro's to make it. And if you want us to make your recipe to the gram exactly, we will do that. We will tell you, here's what it's going to cost. If you freak out, we will say, here's why it costs so much. Here's how it could cost less. And we'll do tests. What we'll never do is change anything without your permission. And that it's two different fields. And you're right, both of them are quite interesting.
Do you think the creativity is like, how many of your partners, I guess, want to see Doug Renfro and the Renfro Foods team creativity kind of mixed in, spiced in with their salsa recipes? Or is it mostly on the Copac side, by the book, here's the T's that you got to cross and the I's that you got to dot exactly to the gram?
I'd say what you just described is probably 1/3 and the other one is 2/3. Having said that, divide that 2/3 in half, and you know, and half of them literally have us make everything up. And they'll give us feedback. We'll send samples. And they're like, okay, do what you just did. A little more garlic, a little less salt, da-da-da-da-da, but we're doing it. And then there are those that just need us to help them tweak and be creative and to guide them with, no, for the love of God, don't use that ingredient. Because if they run out of it 3 times a year and or it's $400 a pound, but here's something you could use instead. So they do tend to value that. And they also know at the end of the day, we'll do what they tell us to do.
Right. So I want to go back, Doug, a second to something that you brought up that I'm curious about, which is you're the number eight salsa brand in the country. Or is it the country or the world?
We don't really have rankings for the world, but okay. The world, it declines. Hot sauce, the world eats a lot of. Salsa, they're learning, but it's not huge. Yeah.
Sure. So the number eight salsa brand in the country, you're going up against these behemoths. If you double, you're still number eight. I think that's a crazy stat to consider. How do you then evaluate success, if not for, you know, how you rank up against your competitors in terms of, you know, total size? Because I think for a lot of businesses, it's here are my competitors. We're all on somewhat similar playing fields in terms of scale. And now if I get one leg up on them in this way, then I, you know, move up in the rankings. And it's a very tangible benchmark that you're trying to achieve on a day-to-day basis. And as you go up and down, you kind of evaluate how you do relative to your peers. But it sounds like you're peerless because of your scale and relative to the other people on that list. So how do you kind of evaluate your success separate and apart from that?
We're looking at, so when I do a store check, it's pretty common for me to go into a retailer and look around, and we make things for five different brands and can be in different categories. You know, we make barbecue sauce, bean dip, queso, marinades. So we may be on multiple aisles under multiple brands, including the store's brand and our brand. And the more facings that we have, the warmer and fuzzier my heart gets. Is what we're looking at. Renfro's is not suddenly going to be the number four salsa in the country. You know, not going to happen, because the top two brands are owned by Campbell Soup and Frito-Lay Pepsi, neither of which Renfro's is scaring. So what we can do, though, is make, you know, the private label salsa for lots of different chains in the country and brands that they love.
Yeah, I think that's great. I would be remiss, Doug, if I didn't ask you during this podcast, what's your favorite flavor that Mrs. Renfro's has? Or is it like your children, you can't really pick?
No, I can pick. not on the children. Mango habanero, it lives in my fridge every day of the week because it's sweet heat. My tongue personally stops there. Our habanero salsa is like five times hotter than the mango habanero, and they're number one or two for us nationwide. Believe it or not, ghost pepper is number three or four for us nationwide.
Wow.
But again, not in my fridge because I enjoy it like for two bites. But you'll see a child, you know, gobbling up ghost pepper after school every day. Everybody's tongue is different. So when someone comes up at a trade show and they ask you, is this hot? I say, I don't know. We're about to find out. Bite it. Let's find out, because what's hot to you is not hot to me, vice versa. But mango habanero, we'll have chicken soft tacos probably every other week. Also, it's good on eggs. I encourage people to just drink the whole jar like a shot, but very few people listening.
I could do that with a green jalapeno. That's my flavor of choice. But I think it's kind of interesting. It's like, how do you, when you're doing R&D and when you're coming up with new flavors, how do you know when to stop in terms of flavor intensity, in terms of heat, in terms of all these things that, you know, if you and I take the same chip with the same salsa, I might, you know, be on the floor, you know, sweating, trying to drink a gallon of milk. And it's, you know, what you're eating with eggs for breakfast.
If it's going to have Renfro on the label, I will first cook it in Excel to make sure the price parameters work. And then I'll do what I like. And then I'll get my two cousins that run the business with me and our sales director for Mrs. Renfro's and my key R&D person. And really, we're not fancy. We don't have focus groups. We don't do panels. If we like it, we tend to think you'll like it. And that's worked for us for several decades. But certainly when you're doing it by yourself, you get tongue fatigue. And there will come a point where I just can't tell any more differences. And that's when you bring in, you know, family members and the QA to help say, yeah, don't you think that should be a little saltier or a crunch? I think we should have a little more onion, or let's get a little more crunch in this, or a little more texture. But it's for Renfro, it's a very tight group. And again, with private label Copac, they sort of care what we think, but sometimes they don't. So we're like,
right.
You tell me what you want and we will execute.
Well, if you need an extra taste tester, I could send you my address.
I'll put you in the list.
So, Doug, my last question for you is, you've had so many innovations in the space and you've built this company, like you, the Renfros, have built this company up for the last 80 plus years. Where do you see the future of Renfro Foods going? You have so many irons in the fire. You know, there's lot of potential, you know, opportunities for growth and for continuous improvement. So,
and it's funny, people were always asking about, you know, what's next, or are you getting close to retirement? I said, my cousins and I are seeing exciting things every day. We've started selling to customers in Dubai and South America. We've done some major CapEx projects. In the last 5 years, we doubled our shipping warehouse. We built a two-story and very nice production employee break room with upstairs offices for QA production scheduling. We did a wonderful mural on the outside of the building featuring my grandmother and our branding. On our core building is over 100 years old, and now we have two city blocks and on the street in between. But as you're driving around, you can now see my grandmother as you approach. And we're doing, you know, the customers that come to us are very interesting, and it's fun and refreshing, and it invigorates your mind to come out with these new products for people and make them happy and not, you know, not lose money at the same time. And we're still, my cousins and I, we big believers in nonprofits. I've been on the local musical theater board for 20 years. My cousin's done work with the American Heart Association. Our local food bank, we're big supporters of. So there's always something to keep your mind going. And so for right now, we're just hunkered down, doing more of the same and enjoying life.
Awesome. That's great to hear. Well, thank you so much, Doug. Appreciate your time. And here's to 80 more years of Renfro Foods.
Thank you. Cheers.
Awesome. Thanks.